So, as some of the listeners of the podcast are probably aware of, China, over the past few months, and most importantly, ending last week, has just held a historic set of meetings to determine the composition of the new Chinese leadership out of this National Party Congress, the 18th Party Congress. And in particular, within this, we're well aware and have been aware for at least a year, if not longer, that Xi Jinping would become China's paramount leader. There were issues, though, about what the composition of the rest of the top leadership group would be, and much of the speculation going into last week related to whether there would be 9 or 7 members of the standing committee, and just what sort of background those people would be, if they'd be sort of those who are close to Xi or others. And what we're seeing out of the final composition is rather obvious indications of a divided Chinese leadership, in which no individual is in a particularly strong position, and various groups, perhaps even we call them factions, are continuing to debate with each other over both the nature, I think, of China's domestic political system and its situation in the international sphere. And what this means is, the upshot of this, at least within China, and then we could talk more about what it means with China's relationship with the outside world, is that while we're likely to see, and have seen quite a bit of talk about the prospects for major political reform, they're unlikely to occur in the near to medium term for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think that there is no one within the Chinese leadership right now who has the power to push major political change through. Everyone is constrained by these kind of interlocking sets of factions and different sort of groups. Alongside of that, I think that you see in each of these leaders, whether it's Xi or Li Keqiang or others, the fact that they have risen to prominence within the system that they're now being asked by some to reform, and as a result, would appear to have very little motivation for instituting fundamental reforms, particularly sort of dismantling the party-state apparatus. And the simple way of thinking about this is there is no one within this new leadership, Xi included, who could constitute a Chinese Michael Gorbachev. It just doesn't exist right now. That being said, I do think that Xi and his fellow members of the Standing Committee are well aware of the fact that China is reaching a bit of a glass ceiling or an outer limit to how much its economic development is sustainable given the stasis within the political system and the types of endemic corruption, limited transparency, scandals that have emerged over the last few years. So what we're likely to see out of it is probably some incremental modifications regarding trying to increase transparency, regularity, and accountability of the Chinese political system in hopes of placating some of the underlying social unrest which exists within China and the yawning social economic inequalities which have come about through the deepening of economic reform. And I'm not either optimistic or pessimistic about where this is likely to lead, except to state that it seems highly unlikely that you'd see the types of rapid political transformations which unfolded 20 years ago in the Soviet Union and subsequently in Eastern Europe, and more recently in the Arab Spring context in the Middle East and Northern Africa. So the Chinese system right now is not moving along particularly efficiently, but it also isn't fundamentally broken. I think as a result, while some are predicting big changes, we're likely to see more continuity than transformation for the time being. So we can then transition the conversation from focusing primarily on these recent developments in the leadership and thinking about the domestic political implications of those, of these changes, into an area where I have a little bit more expertise, which is China's relationship with the outside world. And in that regard, I was really honored to moderate 2 weeks ago now the Lund debate here on campus between Aaron Freeberg and Mike Lampton. The title of it was, Is China the Next Superpower? Or the New Superpower, actually. And what was interesting is, while Freeberg and Lampton have come from very different intellectual traditions within the study of international relations, they generally concurred regarding the answer to this question, is China the new superpower, in saying that it is not, that for different reasons, its power is constrained. For Freeberg, he was emphasizing the facts that China's power projection capabilities and a number of various sort of sectors are really still quite limited and don't measure up in any meaningful way to the United States, or thinking a little bit more historically, to the Soviet Union in the context of the Cold War. In contrast, Lampton took a broader kind of structural stance on this and contended that it is something anachronistic to even use the superpower term within the context of the current international order, in which levels of globalization and interdependence have expanded so rapidly that all states are, to a degree, dependent on each other and their power is constrained. So he felt it was probably, it's not only a misnomer to refer to China as being a superpower, but even raise questions about the degree to which the United States can accurately be described as a superpower today. I think that I tend to agree with their assessments in this regard, but my thinking about it is somewhat different as well. To me, it seems what we really have in China now is what could be called a paradoxical great power, and that it has accumulated fairly impressive strengths abroad over the last decade. I mean, China, just in the context of the upheaval in Libya a year and a half ago, was able for the first time to dispatch naval capacity into the Mediterranean and to help evacuate its citizens, not in terms of the military presence per se, though, but in regards to having a presence in an ocean, which is quite a ways away, obviously, from China's own shores. So it has this growing international influence and international profile in Africa, for example, in terms of trade and investment patterns, and in South America as well. But at the same time, internally, it's facing a set of growing challenges in regards to political stability and economic development. Related, for example, to the collateral damage being caused by this rapid economic development in regards to environmental pollution, individuals in sort of decaying state-owned enterprises concerned about their pay, on and on. There's a set of issues which have led to social unrest. And so you have a leadership that has at its disposal a great deal of influence on the world stage, but is facing real difficulties at home. And I think as a result, is primarily focused on these domestic challenges, and the way it's behaving in the international sphere is a byproduct of how they're trying to manage a transition beyond the level of deep integration they have with the world economy now into another stage of development moving forward. In this regard, Susan Shirk, a number of years ago, wrote a book that got quite a bit of publicity, in which she labeled China a fragile superpower. And I tend to agree with aspects of that assessment, but think that the contrasts and contradictions between Chinese power and Chinese weaknesses have become even more pronounced over the past 3 or 4 years. And as a result, it makes predictions about China's likely behavior really rather quite difficult. I don't think the United States has anything in particular to be worried or concerned about in terms of direct challenges to fundamental American interests, especially outside of Asia. But at the same time, it is somewhat changing the game on the world stage, in that you do have regions like Africa and South America that can look both to Beijing and to Washington for guidance and assistance and influence, not in the way that the Soviet Union and the United States were facing each other in the bipolar structure of the Cold War, But it is a new dynamic or a new ripple to the post-Cold War world that I think both now Beijing and Washington, the leaders in both countries, are grappling with and are uncertain what to make of it. So I've been then discussing the degree to which there are certain sort of paradoxes or contradictions within China's emerging role on the world stage. And I think as I address these, it leads to the next set of questions or concerns, which is what can and should the United States do as a result of these types of changes? And especially because of the fact that we had the prospect of a leadership transition in this country, one that ends up not occurring with President Obama's re-election, but having that coincide with this set of meetings within China in which Xi has consolidated his control and we're moving now past the Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao era, there has been a lot of discussion in the media and amongst academics about the degree to which the United States might want to or need to try to reshape aspects of the bilateral relationship today. And one of the more most high profile of these sort of pieces was an editorial that Lin Xinpei recently contributed to the New York Times, where he was calling for a reset in U.S.-China relations. And I thought that while I respect Lin Xin's work, I've known him for a number of years, that his call for a reset was actually a little bit misguided and unlikely. To begin with, it struck me that it's far from clear that anyone on the Chinese side would be strongly in favor of resetting the relationship. And echoing some of the comments I made earlier in the podcast, it also stretches the imagination to think that there's anyone in the Chinese leadership right now, Xi or anyone else, who has the authority to undertake some sort of a broad initiative that would change in a fundamental way the tone and tenor of U.S.-China relations, for example, maybe leading to some sort of a fourth communique that would be related to Taiwan. In fact, you have on the Chinese side a leadership which is somewhat divided and unlikely to take kind of bold initiatives. On the U.S. side, I think to a lesser degree, the same sort of observations hold true. While Obama won a resounding victory, he's still, in light of the fact that the House continues to be under Republican leadership, dealing from a position of divided leadership. And his greatest concerns are going to be here at home in obviously dealing with this fiscal cliff, which has attracted so much attention. And within that context, I think then, he's also unlikely to take in a major initiative on China that would move past the Asian pivot language of the past 2-3 years and the subsequent language of rebalancing in the region. I think that Pei was probably aware of these constraints, and he was writing more along the lines of forwarding an aspiration rather than a practical policy goal. And I don't disagree with him. I mean, it's worth thinking quite a bit about how the relationship could be reshaped. But at the same time, Pei and others who are more pessimistic about U.S.-China relations today, I think are a little bit off base in that it seems to me that U.S.-China relations are in maybe rocky waters, as evident in tensions between the U.S. and China related to how Beijing is handling, for example, the South China Sea or East China Sea disputes. But at the same time, we're not in the midst of some sort of a hurricane or major storm. So one way to think about it is yes, the U.S. and China are not friends on the world stage, but my sense is that there's an awareness at the top of both countries that our fates have become intertwined. And even if we do have differences, the frictions produced by such contentions are likely to be contained. In short, and maybe to close up the podcast, it strikes me that neither side appears to have the motivation or will to change the basic contours of their relationship with each other, for better or for worse. What's possible, perhaps, and maybe to end with a note of optimism, is that America could, or and Obama more particularly, could take the lead in an effort to seek out points of potential common interest and downplay those of obvious contention. And it was in that sort of a context that I recently wrote for The Diplomat that addressing climate change, which is an online publication that gets a lot of attention in Asia, that addressing climate change could be emerging as an issue of mutual concern for both countries, and it could lead to unexpected compromises and outcomes that would be beneficial then not only for the U.S. and China, but could have an obviously positive effect also for world politics more broadly.